This week, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke said that climate change has nothing to do with the increasing frequency and intensity of wildfires in the West. Well, that's not true, according to accepted science, which concludes that this era of megafires is linked to long-term warming and specifically human-caused climate change. How is it that so many argue that? In 1988, Republican presidential nominee George H.W. Bush made a speech about confronting the relatively new phrase to many, climate change. And it turns out it's not really that new at all. Let's get the backstory, the history from our friends at the weekly podcast Backstory. Brian Ballow, you there?
I am. Good to be here.
And Nathan Connolly, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And let's start with you. Climate, you tell us, was a concern even for the earliest settlers in America. People feared that inclement weather was a sign of the powers of evil. There was a famous sermon about that. So tell us a little about that.
Well, sure. I mean, I have to say right up front that concerns about climate and one's behavior are really as old as Noah, right? Mm-hmm. And you can go back to Increase Mather, a very prominent pastor and minister in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, who is talking about the voice of God in stormy winds. It's the title of a very famous sermon where he talks about natural processes effectively responding to human behavior, and that if people police their behavior, they'll get God to give them the kind of weather and climate and environment that they need. Now, Mather, of course, recognized that there was a human hand in some of this. And so he was able to think at least about how people's ability to till the land or at least to moderate some of the environments around them might allow for, say, crops to grow more easily. But it was absolutely the case that divine providence had some role to play in the way that human beings should relate to their environment and would.
Well, then you've got Thomas Jefferson, who also was concerned about the climate initially because the Brits were critical of New England climate. And he wanted to make the point that all the activity that was going on here in colonizing was altering the climate, but for good.
Oh, boy, Robin, let's count the ways that the Brits were critical of their American cousins. But yes, Jefferson thought that because America was cultivating, cutting the forests and creating farmland, that this was drawing sea breezes farther inland. And since he assumed this was working to improve the climate of places like Virginia, he said, let's get some more of this. In fact, he even suggested that Spain build a canal through the Panamanian Isthmus. And it wasn't just to send ships through it. He really believed that this would draw sea breezes inland and help the entire North American continent.
Well, but then there really started to be concern about what for many years was called global warming, climate change only recently. And I know you've got something to share on that, Nathan, but I was just looking at this writing in the journal Nature in 1882, and H.A. Phillips writes about the research in hydrogen and marsh gas, and he concludes, from this we may conclude that the increasing pollution of the atmosphere will have a marked influence on the climate of the world. That's in 1882.
Yeah, I mean, the literature on this actually is a half century even before that among the scientific community. I mean, it's going to surprise some listeners to think about the 19th century as a time when people were already writing in some, you know, volume about the effect of human activity on the climate. In 1827, you have French scientists who begin to talk about a so-called hothouse effect. 1896, Swedish scientists get in the mix, and you have a wonderfully titled paper called On the Influence of Carbonic Acid in the Air Upon the Temperature of the Ground, right? And Robin, what's so critical to think about in terms of the age of this reporting and the science is that climate denial is just as old. So if thinking, for instance, about the 1912 moment, you have the Cleveland Plain Dealer in July of 1912 with the great headline, How Smoke Improves the Climate, right? And this is just a quick quote. The more perfect the envelope of carbon dioxide becomes, the more the heat of the sun is kept in the atmosphere and the milder the climate will grow. And it goes on to talk about how the polar north and the polar south will lose much of their terror, unquote, right? So even if there's an acknowledgement of the science, the effect of that science is still being debated, even in the turn of the 20th century.
Well, on the other hand, in New Zealand, you have a paper published in 1912.
So in August of 1912, there's a New Zealand newspaper that really, the article article is brilliant. It's only 61 words, right? And all it basically says is that we're burning 2 billion tons of coal a year. And with that, we're adding some 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere because of the chemical reactions. And that effect will, again, raise the temperature, right?
In fact, the effect may be considerable in a few centuries.
In a few centuries. That's right.
And here we are.
That's right. One thing that's important to keep in mind about the moment is that people are much more immediately concerned with man's impact on the weather. So there's an idea that as much as we can talk about the climate in kind of broad terms, how do we make it rain? How do we bring water to certain parts of the country? And so people begin to draw a really important distinction between climate and weather, and frankly are much more concerned about how they can control the weather to meet more immediate ends.
Yeah. Brian Ballow, talk to us about, you know, companies like GE during the Cold War. They began climate manipulation, you know, cloud seeding and stuff, but draw the line from that to climate change.
Well, what GE did was we would call weather manipulation today. They made it snow in the Adirondacks, and all kinds of people wrote into them, you know, wanting snow on demand for Christmas pageants, for movies, that kind of thing. But the same physicists and chemists who were working on this weather manipulation began to realize that with more powerful techniques, they might begin to reshape climate. Mm. And this same kind of science that led to potential snow for Christmas pageants was soon being developed and weaponized to actually change the climate over some of our enemies, specifically the Soviet Union.
I mean, it's amazing to think about the moment of being, you know, aware of climate and all the different ways you can use it, because really the 60s and 70s become a period of broad consensus about humans' impact on the environment. President Johnson writes a very important report on restoring the quality of our environment, Earth Day in 1970, to the point where even oil companies like Exxon really do have to get into the act. You have Exxon scientists who are working on trying to figure out how to, you know, deal with the problem of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
But right? They also hid their concerns about climate change.
Well, in part. I mean, part of it relied, frankly, on what the regulatory environment was. So by the time you reached the Reagan era, there wasn't the same kind of morale in the White House around dealing with the climate that they found during the Carter administration. And then ultimately, it turned into a kind of internal conversation among Exxon executives where they were aware of the climate science but didn't really want too much of it to go public. In fact, what in fact happened was in 1989, Exxon basically joins a lobbying company and begins to now start sowing the seeds of climate denial.
Yeah. Well, let's leapfrog a little bit. You've got, as we said, George H.W. Bush and his opponent, Michael Dukakis, both competing to see who could be more concerned about climate change.
Yeah, that tank that Dukakis drove around and left quite a carbon footprint. Not,
yeah, right. And in that same year, you've got NASA scientist James Hansen, who went before the Senate Energy Committee, said, you know, time to stop waffling on this issue. But what happened? Some in the press, you know, we debate in the media, were we too slow to say you don't have to have an opponent of the notion of climate change or global warming on every time you talk about it? There's that conversation going on about were we too slow to just say this is accepted science? What happened? How are we still divided on whether or not it's even true, as it's pretty much understood we're in it?
Well, I hate to simplify it all and call it interest group politics, but there are a lot of financial interests, and frankly, there are a lot of jobs that are very connected to the fossil fuel economy. And we shouldn't be surprised that those people who are engaged in that line of work are going to defend that way of life pretty vigorously. And, you know, frankly, we all enjoy the benefits of being able to drive as much as we want and not pay the full costs of carbon fuel.
I keep going back to that 1912 New Zealand article titled Coal Consumption Affecting Climate and the Furnaces of the World Burning Tons of Coal, Adding Tons of Carbon Dioxide to the Atmosphere. This tends to make the air a more effective blanket for the Earth and to raise its temperature. The effect may be considerable in a few centuries.
I love that line because it brings one point home, which is, you know, our time is not the world's time. And regardless of whatever debate we have, Mother Nature is going to get the last word.
Yeah. And you have the last word in this segment. That's Nathan Connolly, along with Brian Ballow, historians, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory, with the backstory of climate change, global warming. Brian, Nathan, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.